You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
No Child Left Behind, the Bush administration's signature education law, is up for renewal soon, and there's been a lot of speculation over what President Obama will do. The consensus opinion is that he seems inclined to continue some key aspects of the program, including school accountability, school choice, and data-driven educational evaluation. Surprisingly, one of the biggest critics of the plan is Diane Ravitch, the noted education historian who was initially one of No Child Left Behind's strongest supporters. She's written a book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, published by Basic Books, to explain her change of heart, and I'm very pleased that it brings her back to our show today. Welcome.
Hi, Leonard. If I weren't on the phone with you, I'd be calling to pledge my renewed support for WNYC.
Well, you could do that right after we finish our conversation.
As soon as we hang up.
You point to a moment in November 2006 when you realized that No Child Left Behind and all that it represented, accountability, choice, high-stakes testing, wasn't working. What happened?
Well, I was invited to by a conservative think tank to a conference about the remedies in No Child Left Behind. And there were about a dozen scholars reporting on its progress or lack thereof across the country. And I was supposed to summarize the day's discussions. And every single person got up and delivered a paper on why No Child Left Behind wasn't working. So at the end of the day, after hearing about how it wasn't working in California, it wasn't working in New Jersey, it wasn't working in rural Kentucky, it wasn't working in Florida, I concluded it wasn't working. It wasn't really difficult. But then the following year, the national federal test scores came out and said very little progress had been made. And in fact, I realized more progress has been made before No Child Left Behind than since it. And at that point, I really became a very outspoken critic. I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times in October of 07 saying this law should be ditched. It's not working, and we should get rid of it. I've been really, really upset to discover that President Obama is not getting rid of it. He's going to rename it, but he's keeping all the punishments intact, and we'll still have this regime of test-based accountability where every child who goes to a public school in America will take tests in reading and math, and everything else will be ignored.
Was it difficult to reject the plan that you had once supported so vociferously?
Well, it was difficult in that I was surrounded by lots of people who thought it was working very well. But once I came to the conclusion that it wasn't working, I found myself distancing myself from I'd been part of a couple of very powerful conservative think tanks, and I have friends there. I hope I still do. I'm not sure. But I eventually had to leave them because I couldn't accept either No Child Left Behind nor the punishment of schools and teachers, and now this tremendous drive to privatize public education, which has gotten so much stronger since President Obama has thrown his weight behind it.
Well, why do you think, despite all of the evidence of the contrary, all the evidence that has forced you to change your mind, so many conservatives and, in the case of the White House, liberals, are still in support of this?
Well, Leonard, to me, I've thought about this a great deal because it involved a very fundamental reexamination of things that I had been writing about and thinking about for many years. And the biggest puzzle to me is that I see solutions and proposals that came from very, very conservative think tanks, from, for instance, the Hoover Institution, one of them being privatization, charter schools, vouchers, anything other than public education, and the other being this idea that teachers would be judged by their students' test scores and that teachers would be fired if the scores didn't go up. These are very, very right-wing ideas, and they're now being championed by the White House. And I honestly can't explain why President Obama and Secretary Duncan think that these are good ideas, because there is no evidence behind them. And I think there's quite a lot of evidence that they're going to do irreparable damage to the teaching profession as well as to public education. So it's a puzzle. I can't answer your question.
You spend a good part of the book focusing on New York City schools, despite the fact that the book is ostensibly focused on education nationally. Is New York a special case, or is it very typical?
Well, I actually, there are 11 chapters. New York City is one of them. But New York City really, I would say, got me started thinking hard, because I watched what was happening with Mayor Bloomberg and Chancellor Klein, and was not at all pleased to see their move to dismantle neighborhood schools. to break up schools that in some cases were struggling with very low-performing kids and then distribute the low-performing kids around to different schools. There's a kind of a, I felt it was like a shell game, that instead of addressing fundamental problems of non-English-speaking kids, immigrant kids, homeless children, kids who have all kinds of special needs, instead we've been in this 8 years of organizational change. Actually, I think what's happened in New York City is in many ways a mirror image of No Child Left Behind. It's been a focus on organizational change and on testing, and I don't think either has shown terrific results. I know that the city just got a positive report on the national scores on reading, but it's taken 6 years to get it. And that, meanwhile, many millions of dollars have been spent without having really big improvements across the board for the kids, and that's what matters.
An awful lot of kids who have moved up the ladder with no improvement in their cases.
Well, we still have in the city, in New York City, something like 75% of the kids who graduate and go to community colleges require remedial education. And the one thing that has been focused on all those years for them is reading and math. And, it's sad when they have graduated high school and then discover at a two-year community college that they have to be placed into remedial courses.
And there was no, the national scores were only good for fourth graders. There was no real gain for eighth graders.
Well, that's right. And that's what's especially surprising, because you would think that after having ended social promotion, the scores in eighth grade ought to be going up. They should be going up even faster than the fourth grade scores. But the eighth grade scores have been flat now since 2002. Actually, there's been no change probably for the last 10 years in the eighth grade scores.
My guest is Diane Ravitch, whose latest book is The Death and Life of the Great American School System. One of the education success stories you focus on is in School District 2 in New York, which includes much of Lower Manhattan and the Upper East Side. What happened there?
Well, District 2 became it was portrayed as a model for the nation because the scores went up in District 2 in the late 90s and mid-90s, late 90s. And many articles and scholarly papers were written about balanced literacy as having been the great silver bullet or panacea that had caused a dramatic increase in test scores. But the reason I focused on District 2 was because it then became the model for San Diego. And in San Diego, Anthony Alvarado, who I think is a great educator, was brought to San Diego and told, in effect, force this on the teachers, coerce them, humiliate them, do what's necessary, make them do what you did in District 2. So it became important to me to understand what happened in District 2. And in going back and looking at the demographics, I discovered District 2 was not at all typical of New York City. New York City, the public school system is majority black and Hispanic. District 2 was increasingly white and Asian. In fact, it was majority white and Asian. So there was nothing typical about District 2, but what I found was that over the period in which the scores were going up, the district was becoming richer, whiter. The Asian population stayed the same at about 34%, but the white enrollment increased, and the number of affluent families increased. And this has an impact on test scores, and the test scores went up as the population became less poor, less black, and less Hispanic. But nonetheless, this was portrayed as a success story, and so then balanced literacy went to San Diego, where it was shoved down teachers' throats. And then when Klein and Bloomberg took charge, they insisted that everybody had to do balanced literacy because they thought it worked in District 2 and that it worked in San Diego, but of course none of that turned out to be true. And so we've had 6 years now in which we've finally seen a gain at fourth grade, but none at eighth grade, and we've had balanced literacy throughout the city. So I had thought in 2007, when the city got no gains on its national test scores, that it might be time to reexamine the reading program, but that never happened. So we're still struggling with reading in the city.
A big part of your criticism of the situation in San Diego stems from your belief that effective principals, superintendents, and even chancellors must have some classroom experience.
Well, yes, and I've actually been these past few months since the book came out, I've been traveling the country. I'm actually just recovering from a severe case of laryngitis that came about because I've been traveling nonstop. And one of the points that I make again and again is we need experienced teachers. We need principals who are themselves master teachers because they're the ones who are going to evaluate the teachers. And we should have experienced educators at the helm of every school system so that they can make wise decisions about curriculum and instruction. I think one of the things that's been so negative and destructive about No Child Left Behind is this idea that if you just focus on punishing people and firing people and closing schools and organizational change and testing, that that somehow is going to lead to a dramatic improvement. And I think after 8.5 years, it's obvious that it has not led to a dramatic improvement. And so we're now doubling down on the testing and the organizational change. And I find it frightening. I mean, I've spent decades studying education, and I think we're heading in a direction now that's quite dangerous to the future of public education.
Now, most of the leaders in New York City's Department of Education don't have backgrounds in education. Joel Klein is a lawyer, for example. Do you see that as a problem here as well?
Well, I think that the tone that's been set, and it's certainly permeated the organization, is that curriculum instruction are not very important. I think just a few weeks ago, the Department of Education.
I hope we didn't lose Diane Ravitch, or that Diane Ravitch, we're speaking to her from out of the city, but it's not like we're talking to from Baghdad or something. Let's take a little break, and we will come back. We shouldn't take a little break? Okay, we're actually reestablishing contact with Diane Ravitch, whose book is called The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. It's published by Basic Books, and as you've been hearing, it is a total reversal for her, represents a total reversal for her, because most of the things that we have seen implemented as a result of No Child Left Behind have failed in her estimation. She was a major supporter of it. We will go to a little break, and we'll come back with Diane Ravitch in a little while. Stay with us. We're back with Diane Ravitch, a research professor of education at New York University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. From 1991 to 93, she was Assistant Secretary of Education and Counselor to Secretary of Education Lamar Alexander in the administration of George H.W. Bush. President Clinton appointed her to the National Assessment Governing Board, and she is the author of over 20 books. The most recent one is called Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. It's published by Basic Books. Some of the biggest failures of the No Child Left Behind for you have been the fact that it allowed states to dumb down their state tests so that they could look as if they were making improvements. What are some of the instances of tests being dumbed down?
Well, I think the biggest example of that is New York State, although Illinois would be a close second. These are states where when they began the testing for No Child Left Behind, standards were set at a certain point, and then every year the passing mark got lower and lower and lower. It's simply the fact that when you say to teachers and to kids and to parents the only thing that matters is reading and math, then teachers teach to the test. The curriculum gets narrowed. There's no incentive. There's a lot of incentive to teach reading and math, and there's no incentive to teach history or literature or foreign languages or geography. We've seen nationally many, many districts that have eliminated the arts and have had less time for physical education. I've talked to teachers and district leaders who told me that their district can no longer afford to give kids a full physical education program. New York City doesn't have a full physical education program. But the one thing that's incentivized is reading and math basic skills. This is not good education. I mean, people who can afford the best would never send their children to a school that only focused on reading and math and ignored everything else.
Well, when I was a kid, we definitely were taught to the test, the midterm, the final, the regents. But there
were at least curriculum-based. If you're focusing, let's say, on a regents exam in history, then you have to study history. But if all that matters is your reading and math scores, and that's what you're going to be either promoted on or not promoted on, that's what the teachers will focus on.
The recent test data for New York City has just come out. Have we continued to dumb down, and are there any places where the tests are better in your estimation?
Well,
I think it's very clear from the federal test scores that our state scores are grossly inflated. New York State has been reporting gains every single year. When they started with the state testing, the No Child Left Behind style state testing from grades 3 through 8 began in 2006. And every year they have announced dramatic improvement, 5%, 10%, 12%, 15%. The scores are going up, up, up. And now when we see the scores that come from the federal government, none of those gains are real. They all disappeared. As we were saying before about the reading, the eighth grade reading is completely flat. The state had been saying that it's going up. Fourth grade reading, the state's been saying some huge number, like 70 or 80% of kids are proficient. But on the federal test, it's a much smaller number. It's more in line with the national figures, which is about 30 or 35% of the kids are proficient in New York City and in New York State. So there's a dramatic difference between the federal scores and the state scores, and this is true in almost every state in the country.
Because of these issues with standards, you don't support plans to evaluate teachers based solely on student test scores. What do you think of the plan that was recently passed in New York that evaluates teachers only partly on the performance of their students?
Well, I have a fundamental view that I think it's wrong to have legislatures deciding how teachers should be evaluated. The doctors are evaluated by professional standards. Lawyers have professional standards. And I think that the professional organizations in education should be rising up in protest and saying, let's have our own professional standards of evaluation. These should not be decided by legislators, by politicians. They don't know how to evaluate teachers. Some states have passed laws, like Colorado, and there was an effort to do this in Florida, which might eventually pass, saying that teachers' salaries should be based on test scores, that 50% of a teacher's evaluation will be based on test scores. The New York agreement was that it would be 20%, but I think it'll rise after the first year. But this is wrong because there is absolutely no basis in research or in any kind of scientific studies done by people in the education research field that support using test scores as even a partial basis. Of course, they should be taken into account, but to say that there's a formula of 20% or 50% is just nonsense.
A listener asks what you think about ending seniority-based tenure for teachers and principals.
Well, I'd say right now that the impulse is all wrong. The impulse is fire senior teachers so that you can replace them two for one, get two new entry-level teachers for the cost of a senior teacher. That will destroy the teaching profession because we'll be getting rid of senior teachers for no reason other than that they get a higher salary, and it will not be based on who's more qualified. And to base retention solely on test scores will simply intensify teaching to the test, narrowing the curriculum. I mean, we're going about this in a way that is very destructive of the teaching profession. And the faster that we get rid of senior teachers and experienced teachers, the faster we will make this not a profession but just something for itinerant graduate students who want to teach for a while and then move on to something else.
Let's talk about school choice. You argue that it used to be just a euphemism for white magnet programs that attempted to avoid integrating in the wake of Brown versus the Board of Ed. What
right.
happened to move the idea into the mainstream?
Well, you know, as I explain in the book, I tried to give some historical background to all of these ideas, and school choice was stigmatized for a long time because it was associated with white segregationists in the South. And every effort that they made to avoid complying with court-ordered desegregation decisions was made in the name of choice. So it didn't have a very good ring for a long time. But then Ronald Reagan began advocating vouchers. He was a very close friend of an economist named Milton Friedman, and Milton Friedman had been for half a century saying that vouchers were the solution. Just give parents a voucher and let them choose and everything would be fine. And Ronald Reagan was close to Friedman, loved his idea, proposed vouchers. But vouchers had a fundamental problem, and that is that every time they were put on the ballot in any state in this country, they were voted down overwhelmingly. And so the voucher people pretty much moved on to the charter idea, and what they wanted to do with charters was to get the government out of education and to privatize as many schools as possible. And it's now taken on a certain cachet, the charter idea, even though it's come from the right-wing think tanks and various right-wing advocacy groups. Charters now appeal to, certainly to the hedge fund managers because they have these large numbers of very wealthy people supporting charters. But it will have the impact, I'm convinced, ultimately, of undermining public education.
Well, vouchers were also proposed by people who wanted to support parochial schools, and that became a big issue, separation of church and state. What do you say to your critics who charge that choice allows students to escape schools in neighborhoods that have been failing them for decades?
Well, I don't think that's actually true. It is true that it provides an outlet for a very small number of kids who leave public schools. It will leave us with a bigger problem, though, because New Orleans is, I think, a test case. The charter advocates always point to New Orleans as a success. But in fact, what's happened in New Orleans is that they've created a two-tier system. On one hand is the charter system, which has 60% of the kids. And these kids are the ones who are making it. The other 40% are basically the throwaways. And the throwaways are the kids who come from the poorest families. They're the kids with the lowest scores. Over 80% of them can't pass the state test. And there's no plan to create charters for them. So, you know, this is the direction we seem to be moving in, and it will mean the end of public education.
What do you think of the studies such as those by Stanford economist Caroline Hoxby and the Center for Research and Education Outcomes that show that charters perform better in New York City than traditional public schools? Is that another example of the two-tier system?
Well, Caroline Hoxby was a colleague of mine at the Hoover Institution. The Hoover Institution's Correct Task Force, where I was a member, had 10 or 11 members at various times in its history. I was one of the 10 or 11 members, as was Caroline Hoxby. And the task force is devoted to choice, to charters, to vouchers, to accountability. And Carolyn Hoxby is devoted to choice, charters, and accountability. She's a brilliant economist who believes strongly that choice and charters and vouchers will always produce better results. So it is hardly surprising that she would have come up with a study in New York City showing very positive results. I, however, don't think that the positive results would stand up to peer review, because I would want to see Caroline and her supporters call a press conference and produce the kids that she claims actually closed the gap between Scarsdale and Harlem. I believe what she did in her study was to not actually have any number of real children, but rather she did what the economists called extrapolation. She said if they got this gain in 1 year or in 2 years, you could multiply it, and this is what would happen over 8 or 9 years. And it's an economist extrapolation. It's not about real children. So I would want to see the actual number of real children who allegedly closed the gap. I don't think they exist.
I went to a high school that was closed down because it was low performing in Brooklyn, Eastern District High School. You're critical of closing low performing schools.
Well, you know, I think that most schools that are closed can be improved. And I think that closing schools should be an absolutely last resort. And I think there's a bit too much glee, especially in New York City, but also in Chicago, where Arne Duncan was, about closing schools and pretending that this is somehow a solution. You know, Arne Duncan closed a lot of schools, and there's a very good research organization in Chicago which did a study of called When Schools Closed. What they found was that more than 80% of the kids who were in the so-called failing schools were sent to other low-performing schools, and very few kids went to better schools. The kids who went to better schools did better, but most of them did worse because they went to schools that were as bad as the ones that had been closed. So I think that what we should be focused on is not closing schools because that solves no problems, but rather seeing how we can make schools work better. Some of the schools that are being closed now are pretty good schools. I mean, a school like Christopher Columbus in the Bronx or Jamaica High School in Queens, they were serving a lot of kids very well, and I think that with some effort on the part of the central administration, could have become more successful schools. But these schools had kids dumped into them who were either right out of Rikers Island, in the case of Jamaica, or in the case of Christopher Columbus, their special ed population soared over a very short number of years, and that virtually doomed the school. So it's the central administration's decision not to help the school, but in fact to sink it, that caused the school to become even lower performing than it ought to have been.
But haven't we seen any number of instances when there's been increased support, money, tutors, teachers, put into schools, and it still doesn't turn them around?
No, I don't think so. And actually, this whole idea of turnaround, when you're talking about low-performing schools, you're talking about schools that enroll lots of low-performing students. So you have to deal with the specific problems that they have, and they're going to be different in every school. In some schools, they may be low-performing because the kids arrive in high school two, 3, or 4 years behind in terms of their ability to read and do math, despite the so-called end of social promotion. These are still schools that are getting many, many low-performing kids, and they're spending a lot of time just trying to bring the kids up to grade level, and it's very difficult. In other schools, and it may be in the same school, there'll be a problem with having large numbers of kids who can't speak English, can't read English. So to say that the school staff has failed or the school has failed because the kids that it brings in are very low performing to begin with or don't speak English is not dealing with the problems of the school.
My guest is Diane Ravitch, whose latest book is The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. A big theme emerges in your book about the manipulability of data. We've been talking about some of those instances throughout the course of this conversation. Supporters of school vouchers found data that they say improves student achievement, whereas critics found opposite results. You call them the data wars. Is there any way to overcome that?
Well, I'll tell you an example of the data wars that I think has now been resolved, and I think it's awfully important for this discussion, and that's the city of Milwaukee. Milwaukee has had vouchers now for 20 years, longer than any other American city, and there are only three cities that have vouchers, Milwaukee, Cleveland, and the District of Columbia. Milwaukee has had them for 20 years. They also, for almost 20 years, have had a vigorous charter sector. There are 20,000 kids with vouchers. There are almost 20,000 in charters, and now there's a shrinking public system that has 80,000 kids. And there was just an evaluation that came out last month of the voucher program, and it was produced by a group at the University of Arkansas that consisted of people who were both pro-vouchers and anti-vouchers, and they concluded that the kids in the voucher schools are not making progress any more, any better or faster than the ones in the public schools. Now, Milwaukee students are performing in the public schools are performing on par. The black students are performing on par with black students in the state of Mississippi. So whereas we had been promised for years by the choice supporters that more choice would mean a rising tide, that competition would be lift all boats and the public schools would get better, we now see from the federal test scores and from the voucher study that just came out in April from the University of Arkansas that Milwaukee students, black students particularly, who are supposed to be the beneficiary of choice, have not benefited. They have not benefited whether they're in vouchers, charters, or public schools. And 20 years have been wasted with all this organizational change, and it's done nothing for the kids.
Philanthropy, such as the Gates Foundation and the Eli Broad Foundation, are playing a more active role in education reform than ever before. Why do you think that is? And do you think it's something that is a positive change?
Well, in my book, I have a chapter called The Billionaire Boys Club, and it's about the Walton Foundation, which is the Walmart family, and it's a multi-billion-dollar foundation, and the Gates Foundation, which is the largest in the world, and the Eli Broad Foundation, again another billionaire foundation. And these three foundations have focused, especially the Walton has focused all along on choice, and they're supporting charter schools in Albany, for instance, where 40% of the kids are now in charter schools. They've also supported voucher programs, anything but public education. The Gates and the Broad Foundation, which started off with different agendas, have now decided that the answer to public education is more privatization, more charter schools, and particularly a focus on evaluating teachers by test scores. What's unusual, I think, about these foundations is not that they're so rich, but that they have so much influence on policy. We now have virtually a mind meld between the U.S. Department of Education, the Gates Foundation, and the Broad Foundation, where the Department of Education, through its Arne Duncan, through the Race to the Top program, is carrying out the policy choices of the Gates Foundation and the Broad Foundation and using $5 billion in stimulus funds to do this.
What do you think the solution is? Obviously, telling foundations not to give isn't an answer.
Well, I don't know what the solution is. I just wish that somehow we had a U.S. Department of Education that could act independently of these vast foundations. They're free to do whatever they want to do. But I think that when people, let's say people across the country, I get hundreds of emails, like the one I got this morning from Sacramento, California, said, please come to our district. We're going to lose public education. Our mayor wants to have mayoral control to privatize all the schools. And I got one yesterday from North Carolina saying almost the same thing. And then almost every day there's a letter like this saying, where do we turn for help? We have the federal government against us. We have all the powerful foundations against us. The Republicans and the Democrats are now on the same page. Who is there to defend and support public education? This has been one of the most important institutions in our democratic society. And there are many people, especially in, who live in cities, who think that we're at risk. I think they're right. I think public education is at risk. And what's scary to me is to have this alliance, which I think is an unholy alliance, between the U.S. Department of Education, the Gates Foundation, the Broad Foundation, and now all of these people who, from the hedge funds, the billionaire hedge fund managers, who are on board with a group called Democrats for Education Reform that has the same agenda.
Well, you have been critical of Race to the Top, this competition for school funding, but it represents a tiny portion of our educational budget. Do you see it as some kind of a plan for the future that the Obama administration is floating?
Well, I have I regularly blog at Education Week, and I have a blog called Bridging Differences, where Deborah Meyer and I exchange letters once a week. And my letter today is called Just Say No to Race to the Top. Race to the Top encourages, first of all, more charter schools, and second of all, evaluating teachers by test scores, and third, a transformation model of school closings that will lead to more charters, more privatization, and more closed schools. I think it's a very destructive model, and I suspect that, well, if you say $5 billion is not a lot of money. The states right now are so strapped for money that, you know, you look at New York State, and so many politicians are saying we have to have the money. Well, the money is not to close budget gaps. It's not to rehire teachers. It's not to stave off the cuts that are coming. It's just to do what the federal government wants you to do. So we will have more charter schools, more of all these things that I think are very destructive. And my guess is that 10 years from now, maybe it'll take 20 years, but maybe as soon as 10 years, we'll look back on this era of Race to the Top and say, where did all these bad ideas come from, and why did we go along with it? And I know why we're going along with it. The states are changing their laws simply to try to get a crack at the money.
Wouldn't New York benefit from getting the $700 million Race to the Top funds?
No, and it would not benefit because you can't rehire teachers with the Race to the Top funds. You can't use it to replace budget cuts. You can use it for charter schools, for evaluating teachers by test scores, for transformation models that involve closing schools, chartering schools, privatizing schools. All of the things that I discuss in my book are what Race to the Top will intensify. I think of Race to the Top as No Child Left Behind 2.0.
A teacher from Stamford, Connecticut left a comment on our show page. It says, something that I find most challenging is a differing value to education in different groups. Many times, my parent group does not understand the need to support the development of their child in many facets of education. And we hear complaints again and again from teachers that if parents would get more involved, if they'd show up on parent-teacher nights, for example, especially the parents of the kids who need the help the most, that we might actually affect some change.
Oh, I think so. I think that if every parent were to get involved and were to do the things that we wish parents would do, like read to their children, make sure that they get a checkup in terms of their health, make sure that they're well-nourished, that a lot of the educational problems in this country would be ameliorated. There's no question about it. But nothing that in Race to the Top is going to change that.
Just one more thing. Amy in Manhattan asked what you think of approaches like the Harlem Children's Zone.
Well, I think the Harlem Children's Zone is a very positive approach to education. I like the idea of addressing all the needs of the community and not just the academic needs. I think that one of the things that we should be concerned about is the health needs of children and also whether their parents have a job and have decent social services. I'm not keen about the Harlem Charter School, simply the charter school associated with that zone, only because right now Harlem is being taken over by charter schools and is at risk of losing public education. And many children will be left behind who don't make it into charter schools or who are kicked out of charter schools and kicked back to the public schools.
You don't offer many solutions to the ills you chronicle in this book other than to argue for a renewed focus on curriculum. Is that where we should put our focus?
Well, I think that we need a combination of, you know, what's called wraparound services, the approach that the Harlem Children's Zone is taking. But I think it should be for all the kids in this society that don't have adequate health care. They should have adequate health care. I think that when you look at a city like Detroit, we're not going to solve its educational problems without addressing the economic disaster of so many of the children's parents. I think that's true in New York City as well. So I think that all, in a way, we're going through an era right now of blaming the schools for everything and saying that if we just create lots of charter schools, then therefore we will have equality. We will never have equality in the society until we address the problems of income equality, and schools don't address that. It takes 20 years before you see the benefits of a good education in terms of children's lives. So I'm actually calling for a broader approach to social issues and not just using the schools as the cure-all, because they're not.
Diane Ravitch is research professor of education at New York University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Her latest book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard. I'm immediately going to go on to WNYC.org and renew my pledge.
We appreciate it. We appreciate all the help we can get.
Thank you.